MechCast, Thursday, December 18th, 2014. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, we are in the midst of the holiday season, and I hope that everything is coming together for you this time of year. I, myself, have been running around over the last week or so, kind of finishing up the last bits of the holiday shopping, and also at the same time trying to keep up to date on what's happening with the Apple and Mac news. And I think we've got a pretty good show for you today. Some really cool hints and tips at the end of the episode, some stuff that I read about here and there as I was perusing for articles. And there's also a lot going on in the Apple news. Got some information about Apple's next generation A-series processors and where production might be happening. Some new guidelines in the Made for I program. A little speculation on what's happening in 2015 with HomeKit, something I'm particularly excited about. And Apple Pay is looking to maybe expand here in the near future into some other countries. We've got all of that. And of course, like I said, some great hints and tips and feedback from you in this episode. But before we get started, I would like to take a moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is lynda.com. Hey, if you need training to get up to date with your software, maybe pick up some new skills, or if you just have a hobby that you want to dig into a bit more, lynda.com is a great service. They offer amazing video tutorials. They have over 3,000 courses taught by industry experts, and they're constantly adding new content. And I am a fan of Lynda for lots of reasons, I guess. One of them is that the videos are super high quality. They are top-notch, great production value. What I really appreciate is that they have not only great video and instruction, but also great audio, because nothing's worse than not being able to actually hear what you're trying to learn. And they have courses that cover everything at all kinds of different skill levels. So whether you're an advanced user and you're wanting to expand your skills, or if you're just getting started out and you need to get up to speed on something. And I also like the fact that lynda.com is constantly creating new learning opportunities within their courses. I just go on there to browse around, and I was doing that this week, and I just noticed they added something called the Code Clinic series. This is on the higher end. It's for programmers, but they have a set of 6 courses where lynda.com authors are solving the same programming problem using different programming languages. So they have the same problem but with different solutions in PHP, C#, C++, Java, Python, and Ruby. So you can get in there and you can compare how the different languages solve the same solution. And you know, most programmers are versed in quite a few different languages, and seeing these kind of various ways of approaching a problem can really go a long way to helping you understand, I think, programming concepts and approaches in general. You can kind of get this higher level overview. Oh, that's how this language does that same solution. And you can kind of compare and contrast. And that's a great way to learn. And I think it offers a more creative learning approach, and really is just one example of the innovative kind of courses that lynda.com offers that I think set it apart from other services that are out there. And because they're at all different skill levels, I also noticed that they now have a new Speeding Up and Maintaining Your Mac course, which would be great for new Mac users and might be a perfect reason to get a gift subscription to lynda.com for those folks on your Christmas list who are, you know, you're the tech support for. So maybe you can give them the gift of, hey, why don't you pick up some new skills for yourself on your Mac and use lynda.com to do it. They have a mobile app, which makes it really easy to sync courses up with your Apple and Android devices so you can learn anytime, anywhere. And on their premium plans, you can download project files so that you can practice along with the instructor. And the great thing is all of this training starts at a low monthly price of just $25, and that gives you unlimited access to everything in the lynda.com library. And for MacCast listeners, of course, Lynda is giving a free trial access to the entire library. You can check it out for a week, and I'm pretty sure you're going to love it, and you're going to want to stay subscribed, and probably give the gift of lynda.com to some of your friends and family as well. Great last-minute holiday gift. We're getting into crunch time, so you might consider that. So that's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to Lynda for their support of the show. As we close out 2014 and start moving into 2015, it is that time where we're going to start to hear rumors about Apple's plans for the next year, rumors coming out of the supply chain of things that Apple are lining up. And one of those is going to be the next generation of A-series processors. So over the past week, we've been getting various reports of where and how Apple may be producing the next-gen chips for iPhones and iOS products in 2015. And first, we got a report from Cult of Mac, who suggested that GlobalFoundries, who is the largest foundry in the U.S., might be vying for Apple's business, which would be great. It'd be great to see Apple to bring more manufacturing back to the U.S. Apple reportedly wants to move from the 20-nanometer production process that they're using for the current A8 series chips down to a 14-nanometer process for the next round. And GlobalFoundries, along with Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing and Samsung, all want in on a bit of the Apple action. Now, it's currently believed that most of the A8 series processors are being manufactured by TSMC, with Samsung possibly filling in a bit. I think it's like a 60-40 split TSMC to Samsung. Depends on whose report you're looking at. But Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation supposedly hasn't been willing to budge on Apple's pricing demands for the next generation of chips. And that is opening up opportunities for both Samsung and GlobalFoundries. So will the A9s really get a made in the USA label? Apple Insider seems to think possibly not, or at least it might not be a USA company that's going to be building the A9 series chips. They reported that trial builds of the so-called A9 are being produced by Samsung using their 14-nanometer FinFET technology, and that they started putting together those trial builds this week. This is according to a report out of ET News. The trial, though, is still happening in the U.S. It's just at Samsung's Austin, Texas-based foundry. So trials happening in the U.S., trial production happening in the U.S. may not mean that the full-blown manufacturing or production is going to happen in the U.S., but Samsung has produced chips for Apple at their Texas facilities in the past. So if they do get the gig, there could be some production still happening in the U.S., even if they are able to beat out GlobalFoundries for that. And Samsung also has lines capable of doing the 14-nanometer process, I guess reportedly in Korea. And I believe that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation is solely in Taiwan. So who knows where the final production is going to happen? My guess is that Apple will continue to go with multiple sources for their chip production, multiple manufacturing partners, just to kind of hedge their bets a little bit. I think Apple really doesn't like to have all their eggs in one basket anymore, although we also heard rumors that Samsung could be getting 100% of the contracts. But I think ultimately it's really too early to tell, and we'll just have to wait for more information to come out as we get closer to actual production time. Remember how we were discussing on the last episode that Apple's app review process really seems to continue to be a mess? And that was prompted by several app rejections, or kind of about faces, that happened over the past week. But these sorts of things happen all the time, where a developer will submit an app to Apple, it will go through the review process, get approved, and then they'll be simply doing a maintenance update, not even pushing out new features, and a new app reviewer discovers something that they sort of interpret as being in violation of Apple's guidelines. And it's really feeling like here we are years later into the app review process, and Apple still hasn't figured out sort of a common training for their app reviewers, or it's not really clear to anyone exactly what the guidelines are or rules, or at least at the very least that they're up to interpretation by each app reviewer. And you would think Apple would want to kind of get to a more consistent level. Well, this week it just shows more how the chaos ensues, because they pretty much did an about face on every one of the app rejections that we heard about last week. And my guess is that a lot of the turnaround comes into play because the media gets a hold of these stories. And this time around, you know, a lot of the rejections were with some pretty well-known, well-established developers in the Mac community. So I think they got a little more media attention than maybe some other developers might get. But, you know, Apple turns around and then completely reverses their decision, which ultimately, in the case of these apps, was probably the right thing to do, or I feel really was the right thing to do. But we shouldn't have to go through this whole sort of back and forth in the first place, in my opinion. It should be, I don't know if they need an escalation process or what needs to happen, where they kind of have a first tier, you know, team that takes a pass at it. And then for anything that gets rejected, it kind of has a vetting process. So it kind of has to go through a double rejection instead of just, you know, one app reviewer being able to turn around. And maybe that's the process that already exists. But again, it's all in this little black box and we really don't know what's going on. But what happened this week was Panic's update to Transmit, which was originally rejected because it used the send to feature to allow uploads to your iCloud documents in the cloud, I guess it's now called just iCloud documents, up into iCloud documents. That was rejected because they said, well, you're not supposed to be able to send files that weren't created from the app into your iCloud storage. So because Transmit was actually allowing you to connect to an FTP server, grab a file, and then push that into iCloud.com, they were saying that's not allowed. But there, as I talked about last week, there's a lot of apps that actually enable that ability. So that decision was reversed shortly after several sites were reporting on the rejection. And then you may remember back in October, there was a similar reversal for pCalc, which they had added a notification center widget that would allow you in the Today view to actually have a little simple calculator. And that was rejected because it was like too much functionality for a Today widget. And that was immediately, you know, turned around. And then the same sort of thing happened last week to the developer of the note-taking app Drafts. His app was rejected because it had buttons that would allow you to open up the app and create a new note with the contents of the clipboard. And they were saying, well, you can't have buttons in there. Today widgets are only allowed to present information, not actually have interactivity. Well, of course, you look at pCalc, which, you know, was rejected and then got reapproved. And it's sort of like, well, there's a lot of functionality in a calculator widget, a lot more than just a button that opens up an app. So again, that decision was reversed this week. And while these are good things, I think it just continues to make Apple look like they sort of don't know what they're doing in the app review process. And you'd think after so many years of experience that we would have these sorts of things hammered out. So good to see Apple doing that. I hope it causes them to go through their internal processes and maybe really decide once and for all, we need to get this figured out, because this stuff showing up in the press, these kinds of rejections followed by reversals happening in the media, really don't make us look too great. And I guess as Apple's been sorting out their app review guidelines, they also appear to be putting together or setting up tighter constraints on third-party hardware devices, specifically cases for your iPhones. 9to5 Mac reported this week that manufacturers will now need to ensure that their case will protect the iPhone from a 1 meter, about a 3.2-foot drop in any orientation, and have it not cause any damage to the phone, either on its front, back, or sides. That is, if they want to get Apple's made-for-iPhone seal of approval the little badge that they can put on the front of their packaging. This is an update to the Made for Eye program, and it goes into some pretty specific requirements, including the fact that the front glass needs to be protected, needs to have at least a 1 millimeter buffer around it so that if the device were to come in contact with a surface face down, that it would be offset by 1 millimeter. So you get that little cushion of protection. I don't think it affords a lot of protection. I'm looking at my Apple case, and it does seem to have and meet that requirement, which you would hope Apple's own case would. But that is now part of the specification if they want to get that Made for Eye blessing. They can either do that, or they're also allowed to have some additional covering the glass as an additional option. But it definitely needs to be protected. And they are going to be doing, it sounds like, 1 meter drop tests to make sure that they work to get that certification. The new rules also ban a number of case materials that aren't environmentally friendly. So moving more into Apple's green initiative, although most of the materials on the list were already banned in the U.S. and Europe at the government level. So it's likely a lot of case manufacturers aren't currently using those materials. And since the Made for Eye just means the logo on the packaging, it really remains to be seen how these new rules will impact case designers or case manufacturing. You're still going to have a lot of third-party cases that will just opt to, you know, not go through the certification process and not be able to put that on their packaging. And I'm sure there'll be plenty who'll sneak it on there anyway. So, you know, I don't know how tightly Apple monitors that Made for Eye program, but it's a good thing for you to look for just as a consumer when you're looking at buying products, because it does give you that sort of added peace of mind that this meets a certain level of specification that's defined by Apple. And it just gives me comfort when I'm buying a product like that. And I also tend to make sure that I buy from, you know, good known Apple partners, people who have been working with Apple for a long time, and it's not just some sort of shady off-brand of case or something like that. In addition to providing new specifications for case designers, Apple also added the first guidelines for companies who want to build CarPlay compatible hardware. The certification will only be allowed for in-dash units that are already built into vehicles or for aftermarket installations that are in-dash. So in the front dashboard, it will not be allowed. You cannot build a CarPlay system, apparently, that offers rear seat or integrations in other areas of the car. The specification does allow for docks or custom cable solutions using the Lightning connector, though most of the current existing solutions right now use the standard USB to Lightning connector. I guess that means you could, you know, build a fancy dock into your in-dash system or have something maybe wired through the glove box that's already kind of wired up. And there's also a requirement in the specification for audio and noise cancellation features. Apple's recommending at least 24-bit, 48 kilohertz audio. They are going to allow for 16-bit at lesser sample rates. So it's not, that sounds like that one's not a hard requirement, but, you know, trying to keep the audio quality up is always a good thing. And there's also definitions for things like the display size. Displays must be a minimum of 6 inches diagonal and have a resolution of at least 800 by 480 with a 30 hertz refresh rate. And unlike cases, CarPlay systems will require a Made for Eye certification. So they have to get the certification in order to be a CarPlay compatible system. Speculation is that that means there must be some sort of special authorization chip that once you get the certification, Apple would either provide or you would need to license, and that would allow for the connectivity to the CarPlay system from Apple compatible devices. So I expect in 2015 we're going to see a lot more CarPlay options. We should see more cars coming off the production line with CarPlay integration. I think we've already heard about some of those from different manufacturers, including, it sounds like, Ford is moving away from the Microsoft Ford Sync and moving into systems that will support CarPlay. And we've already seen a couple of the aftermarket solutions, I think, from Pioneer and Alpine. And I think we're it's looking like we're going to get a few more of those in 2015 as well. And I'm looking forward to that because, you know, as cool as those systems are, pricing is still a little bit high for those aftermarket systems. I think in that, you know, $600 to $800 and up range. And that's a little too pricey for my blood. So I'm hoping there'll be some new creative solutions. And hopefully the fact that Apple now has guidelines for certification that usually starts to generate manufacturers or pique manufacturers' interests. They want to get in on the program and start building new systems. So I'd be curious to know if you have bought one of the aftermarket systems. What do you think about it? I haven't heard from anybody directly. I don't know anybody who has one. So anyone in the community who's maybe installed one, give us some thoughts on your experience. Shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Another technology that I'm hoping to see a lot more out of in 2015 is home automation and home automation products, specifically ones that are going to start integrating with my iOS devices and Apple's HomeKit technology. Cult of Mac had a piece this week about Park Associates. They did a report, and they say that 2015 may be a big year for smart home devices, mainly because of support from Google and Apple with technology like HomeKit. They surveyed 10,000 U.S. households and found that 37% said that they plan to buy at least one or more smart home devices next year. So far this year, thermostats like the Nest have been the big popular smart home product purchase for most people. They make up 27% of device sales for the first three quarters of 2014. But in their study, they show that smart lights may be the most popular product moving into 2015, followed by smart appliances, and then power strips, with the thermostat dropping down to fourth place. The study also says that retailers are going to be devoting more shelf space to connected devices, and that some stores like Best Buy have already set aside 800 square feet in some of their locations just for smart home connected products like light bulbs, thermostats, security cameras, sprinkler controllers, smoke detectors, doorbells, all that stuff. Right now, I personally have some Nest thermostat, or have a rather Nest thermostat, as well as a couple of Nest Protect smoke detectors. My opinion, the trouble right now with these, you know, all these systems that are hitting the market, whether they're from Google or Nest or whoever, is this issue of actually getting the automated part of home automation. You know, a lot of these systems exist autonomously. So you get a certain product from a manufacturer, it has its own app, its own controllers, but really interconnecting them, while it's possible sometimes, it really is a nightmare for consumers because they really don't talk well to each other. So HomeKit has the promise of a solution for this, but it's going to take developers and device manufacturers actually adopting the technology and integrating it to get it to work. Once they do that, that's when I think we're really going to hit the boom of home automation. So I want, you know, certain actions to happen. We need to be able to script things together so that these systems can be truly automated and one can talk to the other and certain actions can trigger other actions and you can have your house sort of working for you. I'm also very hopeful that we're going to get more Siri and voice command integration and all that sort of stuff, you know, so that we can get to that Star Trek future where I can, you know, talk to my house and have it do different things. And I'm pretty excited and pretty positive about this because if you look at health devices and what they've done over this last year, specifically with support for HealthKit, that really bumped up, I think, adoption and support. And it's going to happen more slowly, I think, than we really like, but I think it's coming. And I think 2015 is feeling like the year for it. What do you think? Last week, I did something I usually don't do on the MacCast, and that is talk about an Apple lawsuit. And the reason was is because an almost 10-year-old antitrust case against Apple finally went to trial. This was the iPod antitrust case that was stemmed by the Real Networks technology, where they figured out a way to load Real Networks purchased music onto an iPod and get past Apple's FairPlay DRM. Well, as the trial was progressing, the Wall Street Journal reported on some testimony from a former iTunes engineer, a guy named Rod Schultz. He said he worked on a project specifically to block non-iTunes clients and shut out third-party music providers from being able to compete with the iPod. And since the case basically hinged on this fact and claimed that Apple was using their position in the marketplace to block out competition, the statements seemed to be, you know, pretty damning at first. But as he continued his testimony, he did restate what I consider to be the company line that Apple was giving was that, and that was that, you know, their hand was being forced by the record labels. The record labels were demanding that Apple take these steps to, one, implement DRM technology, but then even more importantly, block any kind of music copying from one device to another. They didn't want music, digital music specifically, going between devices in any way, shape, or form. And so they were kind of saying, you got to keep the iPod locked down. And Schultz was actually a closing witness in the case, and I guess his testimony, you know, did very little to help the plaintiffs. I think they were hoping it was going to help a little bit more, because less than 24 hours after they started deliberating, the jury came back and gave a verdict of Apple being not guilty of violating antitrust laws. So that's good for Apple. The jury decision was apparently unanimous, so there was little doubt that Apple was doing anything wrong. And good news is that the wins for Apple didn't stop there, because you may also remember last time that we talked about the media wanting to get access to a videotaped deposition that was given by Steve Jobs related to the case. Well, a district court judge ruled that the tape should not be handled as judicial record and would therefore not have to be made public. The tapes were made just prior to Steve's death, and they're said to actually be one of his last filmed appearances. So the media was sort of arguing, you know, this is public record, we should have access to this. The judge decided, nope, it's not sort of covered. It's not anything that's in the public interest and needs to be seen. Now, there's actually written transcripts of the taped interview already. And I think, you know, there really is no need for the actual tapes to be aired. Apparently, Steve is looking pretty ill and not too well in those tapes, because it was pretty close to his death. And the media was trying to argue that, well, the videos are going to be far more compelling than the written transcripts. But if you need the information, if you want to know what's happening, you can just get the written transcripts and go through that. So I think I'm in total agreement with the judge on this one. We've been pretty fortunate here in the U.S. because we got Apple Pay back in October, and I've been using it since. It's really great, and Apple, as well as many of you, are probably hoping Apple's going to bring it to the rest of the world fairly soon. Well, good news is that we're hearing reports that Apple is already working hard to bring Apple Pay to additional countries. iClarified noted a job listing that appeared on one of Apple's websites for an Apple Pay intern that included the statement that Apple Pay is, quote, set to expand across Europe, Middle East, India, and Africa. The listing also said that the intern would have a position working with a London-based Apple Pay team, and that that team is already working with issuers, payment networks, and merchants across Europe. And apparently it's not just in Europe where Apple is looking for some Apple Pay help. Apple also posted a position for a Shanghai-based Apple Pay site reliability engineer. This is according to Apple Insider. And so that looks like the company may also be working to expand into Asia and China as well. Unfortunately, the listings offered no insight into what order Apple's going to be rolling out the service in terms of countries, nor did it give sort of any timeline of when it might happen. But we had heard from representatives at Visa. They made some statements that they've been working with Apple to roll out Apple Pay, at least in Europe, sometime in 2015. And you may or may not have heard, but something that is interesting about Apple Pay, because it just relies on standard NFC technology, the systems globally, in many cases, do already work. So it's just a matter of Apple having to set up the partnering agreements with the banks and merchants and payment networks and things like that in various regions. But it's already been reported that Apple Pay users with U.S.-based credit cards can actually use Apple Pay at NFC-supported point-of-sale terminals in other countries. So I've heard of people being able to already use Apple Pay in Europe. And I would assume, again, as long as it's a NFC-supported payment system, it would work in other countries as well. And as far as Apple Pay support in the U.S., Apple continues to expand over here as well. They now say that Apple Pay supports cards representing about 90% of the credit card purchase volume in the U.S. If you remember back in when they launched, it was at about 80%, so they've gained another 10%. Unfortunately, within that 10% is not my Chase Business MasterCard. For whatever reason, and this drives me batty, Chase is only supporting Visa cards. And I don't know if I'm going to have to call them up because I think I'm going to check to see if I can get a Chase Business Visa, but I don't think it's even an option for me. And McDonald's also reported that in November, Apple Pay accounted for more than 50% of their Tap to Pay purchases. So Apple Pay is becoming popular and on the rise. Apple also continues to add more and more bank support. And it was noted this week that the Amway Center, which is the home for the Orlando Magic basketball team, just announced that they are going to be supporting Apple Pay at their sports arena. I absolutely love Apple Pay. I try and use it whenever I can. And I'm being able to use it more and more, which is really, really nice. But I'm also kind of actively or somewhat actively trying to avoid retailers who don't support Apple Pay. I'm not going out of my way yet to avoid those retailers, but if I have an option and it's not too inconvenient, I will opt for going to the retailer who has Apple Pay support versus the one who doesn't. It's kind of my own little mini self-protest. And I'm trying to convince others to do that as well. I think if more and more of us just avoid or do less purchases, you know, even if you just do 10, 15% less purchases with those companies that aren't supporting Apple Pay, they're going to feel it in aggregate. If we all kind of take that position, I think it will make an impact financially, and they may reconsider their decision not to have Apple Pay support in their stores. And then one other final item to note in the news for this week. There's a significant tax change coming for Apple customers in Europe at the beginning of next year. Apple has reminded developers via their iTunes Connect system that after the first of the year, the value-added or VAT tax rate policies are going to change. Apple right now charges a flat VAT tax across the EU for iTunes app purchases. And that's despite the fact that in the EU, VAT rates actually vary pretty significantly from country to country. So after the first of the year, what's changing is they're going to have customers paying value-added tax based on their country of residence, not just this single tax rate. That means that the taxes for countries like the UK are going to go up significantly. They can expect their app prices to actually reflect that higher rate, because I think it's Apple's standard policy to kind of build the tax actually into the price. So the price that you'll see on the App Store will typically include the value-added tax. And then other countries might actually see decreases in app prices. But the increases or decreases are ultimately not going to impact any developer revenues, because all of the revenue is based on or calculated off of pre-tax prices. So that 70-30 split is done all off the pre-tax rate, not the post-tax rate. So developers will continue to make the same commission off of whatever the price point they set for their app is, regardless of taxes. And that's a good thing. I think if you're trying to calculate out maybe or project your revenues over the next year, you're not going to really get hit by the tax change. But the consumer is certainly going to feel it either one way or the other in Europe. no word on exactly what the pricing will look like. But I want to say that the UK, I was reading, has almost a 20% value added tax rate. And that, again, may vary depending upon the region of the UK that you're in. I don't even know how specific Apple is getting. I think right now it's sounding like they're just going to go country by country for the VAT tax rate, but it could get all the way down to that region level. I wouldn't see any reason why technically that couldn't work, but hopefully they're not going to that extreme, at least not yet. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. But before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Drobo. I'm very happy to have Drobo back as a sponsor of the MacCast because I have Drobos. I'm a Drobo customer, and I absolutely love them. If you don't know what a Drobo is, just in case, it is a storage array, a device you can put in multiple hard drives. You can array them, you know, put them together into an array to expand your storage that you have available for your Mac. But what sets it apart is it's safe, simple, and completely expandable. So what I really love about it is you can configure your Drobo in a way that if you have multiple drives in there, you can have one drive fail and still protect your data. Not only that, but as you start to fill up the Drobo with storage, you start to throw your files and documents on there, at any time you can just add a new drive into an empty bay to bring your storage up, or if you're totally full, then you can simply swap out a smaller drive in your array for a new one. They make it really simple to do that. There's lights right on the front of the unit that let you know the status of the drives in your Drobo, so you can see if it's getting full, when you might need to add more storage, or if a drive fails, it will notify you that as well. As a matter of fact, that happened in one of my Drobos, and what was great is I didn't have to panic. I just went out that afternoon, bought a new drive to replace the failed one, popped it out, popped the new drive back in, and it reconfigures itself. It sets that array back up for you. So you don't have to think about, you know, storage arrays and whether or not you need to do RAID 1 or RAID 5 or, you know, who knows what that stuff is. You don't have to think about it with a Drobo. They have a range of products that can serve all kinds of different needs. So they have desktop solutions, they have mobile solutions, 3, 5, 8 drive bay models, so you can go crazy with the storage. But I want to mention to you one of their most popular models, the 4-bay model, they recently updated. They're now on their third generation, and they've really improved the performance over the original design. So it now comes with a USB 3.0 connection that offers great performance. As a matter of fact, Storage Review did some speed tests and got transfer speeds of up to 200 megabytes per second. Really, really fast. There's also a new microprocessor in there. It's dual core, makes it 3 to 5 times faster than the original model. And here's good news. If you want to upgrade, if you have one of the older 4-bay Drobos and you want to upgrade to the new version, you can literally just move the drives from your old Drobo right into the new one. And so this new model's faster, it's better. And not only that, they've added some new features and functionality. So in addition to having the data redundancy with one drive, you can set it up if you'd like to have two drive protection. They also added Time Machine support and an internal battery with a small SSD cache so that if you have a power failure, you're not going to lose any data, even if it's writing to the device. And so they really have thought of everything. And you might think, well, they've added a bunch of new technology, they've got a new model, it's got to be more expensive, right? Well, no. As a matter of fact, the Gen 3 Drobo is 1/3 less than the price of the original Drobo. It has a US list price of just $349. And not only that, because you're a MacCast listener, here's the best part. There are actually two ways that you can get your hands on your own Drobo and get it for even less. From now until December 29th, if you use the offer code HOLIDAYADAM, HOLIDAYADAM at drobostore.com, you can get $90 off your choice of a Gen 3 Drobo, a Drobo 5D, or a Drobo 5N. Or if you're feeling particularly lucky, you can go to drobo.com/maccast before midnight on December 31st, and you can register in a sweepstakes to win your own Gen 3 Drobo. So take advantage of either one of those offers. Go to drobostore.com and use Holiday Adam as your coupon code. Get $90 off. or enter the sweepstakes to win a Drobo over at drobo.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to Drobo for their support of the show. On the last show, I talked about some stories that had to do with encryption on the iPhone, and specifically one where the Department of Justice was saying that Apple's encryption was actually too secure and that they were going too far and it was actually hindering law enforcement efforts, and that they really needed Apple to provide a way for them to be able to get at data in certain situations and unlock devices and all that sort of stuff. And I kind of jokingly also talked about another story that I ran across where a boy was able to hack into his dad's iPhone, and the dad was actually a professor of cryptography, to just make the story even more ironic. But he was able to go in because he wanted to play Angry Birds, and the way he did it was he simply borrowed his dad's thumbprint while he was sleeping, reached over, grabbed his hand, and stuck it to the phone, and away he went. He was able to play with Angry Birds. And I was saying, you know, law enforcement unfortunately can't force someone to unlock their device via Touch ID because, you know, the Fifth Amendment would protect you against self-incrimination. Well, lo and behold, I had forgotten, and I know I had seen this report. I think it was over on Cult of Mac back in October, but there was a report that a judge in Virginia ruled that Fifth Amendment protection does not apply to fingerprints, specifically something like the Touch ID sensor. And the rationale was because a fingerprint is similar to a piece of physical evidence like a key or a DNA sample. So a person could be compelled to provide it when requested by law enforcement. And actually, the article was over on Mac Rumors. Sorry about giving the wrong source on that. But I'll have a link to the original article in the show notes at maccast.com. But the claim is that basically the Fifth Amendment only provides protection for memorized information, things like passwords or passcodes. And because your thumbprint is a physical thing, you could be compelled to or be forced to basically unlock your phone via your thumbprint. Now, that's just precedent. It's one precedent that was set in one court. Doesn't necessarily mean that another judge wouldn't rule differently in a similar situation. It doesn't mean also that the ruling of the Virginia court couldn't be sort of overruled by a higher court decision at some point. So it's not a cut and dry thing. It's also not a cut and dry thing because of how Touch ID works, because Touch ID requires you to set a passcode in order to be able to use Touch ID. So you have to have a passcode in there. Not only that, after 48 hours of not unlocking a device with your fingerprint, it will then compel you or require you to enter your passcode. So if somehow you did something, you got picked up, and your phone was taken into evidence, my guess is they're not going to get around to asking you to unlock it for more than 48 hours. So it may already be past the time, and at that point, it reverts back to the thing you have to have memorized, which would be protected by the Fifth Amendment, which would be your passcode. So thanks to everyone who reminded me about that story, because I had completely forgotten about it. It does set up this sort of level of precedence that could invalidate Fifth Amendment protection for Touch ID. Also on the last show, Gary had sent in this great audio comment and tip about advanced dictation commands. And in that, you may remember, he also had a question about Instant Hotspot that I wasn't really able to help him with. Well, I got new information this week, and I think, Gary, I can help you out a little bit. But just to remind you, the issue was that with Instant Hotspot now in iOS and supported on the Mac, Gary has his hotspot turned on all the time on his phone, and that's because it's a really convenient way to get get connected when you're not near any Wi-Fi, to be able to simply go up on your Mac and see your iPhone's hotspot from the Wi-Fi menu and just pick it, not have to enter any passcodes or anything like that, just connect to it and away you go. The trouble, though, is that when you have the hotspot turned on and you tether your iPhone to your Mac, so you connect it with the lightning cable, lightning to USB cable, It will try to use the hotspot as like a connected modem or connection, basically. It will, you know, revert over to using instant hotspot, and it will show that you have connected to the hotspot even if your Mac is on a different network, connected to an Ethernet network or a Wi-Fi network. So you now have two active connections. And Gary was worried that it might be possible that even though he's already on Wi-Fi, that the tethered connection might also be used for some data and thus start using up his cellular data plan. And that's a concern that I've had as well. I've noticed this thing. I didn't really put two and two together and realize that because I had my instant hotspot on, every time I would dock in my iPhone to my Mac, suddenly the little blue, hey, you've connected to personal hotspot thing would come on. I thought it was like connecting, you know, to my iPad, which was in the other room or something like that. Now I know that, Gary, I'm experiencing the same thing as you are. But one thing that I thought of and didn't have time to test out before the last show, and something that Bruce emailed me about, was maybe you could fix it, Gary, by adjusting the service order option in the network settings on your Mac. So you may or may not be aware that you can go into System Preferences, into Network, and if you look over there on the left, you're going to see a list of all available sort of network connections that you could possibly have or use, including things like being able to do a network connection, say, over a lightning cable or lightning cable. Yes. No, Thunderbolt cable. We're on a Mac on this side, under a Thunderbolt cable. And so you'll typically see things like Ethernet or Wi-Fi, and you'll probably see iPhone USB. That's another connection. And the order of that list on the left, top to bottom, is the priority order of your data connections. So what's supposed to happen is any connections that are active have the little green dot next to them. Those are the ones that are active, and the uppermost one should be the preferred one. So it should try to send data over the highest level connection and then only jump down to lower ones if there's a problem with your preferred connections. And you can actually control the order of that by clicking on the little cog icon, little settings icon at the bottom of that pane, and choosing the set service order option. And then what will happen is a little dialog will pop up, and you can drag the order of those services to set them. And when you hit OK, then that list will readjust and you can set the priority. So one idea would be to simply make sure that you have Wi-Fi and Ethernet set higher than the iPhone USB connection, and therefore it should prefer those connections versus your cellular data connection. Now, I did not try running any tools to kind of verify that no traffic is going over that connection when, you know, Wi-Fi and that one is active and you have Wi-Fi set to a higher priority. But Bruce said he tested that out and that method did seem to work for him. But Bruce's suggestion actually got me thinking, because the iPhone, you know, still does make this connection. You get that blue personal connected bar. You could take his tip, Bruce's tip, one level deeper, if this really bothers you still, Gary. And what you could do is you could actually just remove the iPhone USB connection from your Mac completely. So again, going into System Preferences, into Network, then on the list on the left, select the iPhone USB option and just simply click the minus button at the bottom of the window and click Apply. And that will completely remove that option. And the minute that you do that, when you're tethered, you'll no longer see the personal hotspot connection go into play. And what's cool about that is that when you remove the tethered option, so you undock your phone, you still have access to the personal hotspot feature, because one, personal hotspot is still turned on the device, and two, it's still going to show up over Wi-Fi or the Bluetooth connection. So you can connect to your phone over Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, still use its connection. It's just you're not going to have the tethered option on your Mac anymore. So if you don't care about having that as an option, you might just want to remove that completely. And then there's no confusion, regardless of your set service order. it's not going to be able to use that tethered cellular connection. And then a final reminder from Bruce is that as you're in that network setting, you may also want to go in and clean up your known public Wi-Fi hotspot connections. Because whenever you're in range of a hotspot with the same name, it's going to automatically try to connect to that. So, you know, how many Starbucks Wi-Fi or McDonald's Wi-Fis are you coming in contact with? You could just be driving around and actually connecting to those networks if they're in that known list. So you may want to run through and just clean that up. Those things build up over time. I remember going into one of my Macs at one point, and I probably had, and I'm dead serious, I probably had about 50 to 60 known Wi-Fi hotspots because I just hadn't cleaned it up in years. So now's a good time. Go into System Preferences, go under Network, select the Wi-Fi connection, and then just click on the little Advanced button. And then in the Wi-Fi tab, you should see a section called Preferred Networks. Those are going to be all the Wi-Fi networks that you connected to that your Mac has remembered. And so what you can do is you can select any that you're no longer using anymore and just hit the little minus button at the bottom to remove them. And if you're like me and you're like, I really don't want that list building back up, something else you might want to do is prevent them from being remembered at all in the future. And the way you do that is there's a little checkbox there that says remember networks this computer has joined. Just uncheck that option. And as long as it's unchecked, then it's never going to remember any of the networks that you connect to. So you can still connect to them use them, but the minute that you disconnect, it's not going to be remembered. And the next time you go to that same location, you're going to have to manually pick that from the Wi-Fi selection and connect to it again. So what it's doing is just screening on the network name, the SSID. So you could also click the plus button and add it back in or add ones back in manually that you know you're going to be connecting to. You don't have to have that automatically remembered and, you know, slowly kind of building up this big list of preferred networks again. So totally up to you. You're totally in control. But I thought that was a great reminder and tip from Bruce. And Gary, I hope that you find one of those network connection options helpful to you as well. This week, I wanted to talk to you about a great piece that Peter Cohen wrote up over at iMore. And I think it's great because it addresses something that has bothered me for a really long time. I'm going to have a link to Peter's piece in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to read it. You may even want to pause and read it right now because I'm going to comment on it. But what it has to do with is turning off iCloud services and how freaking scary Apple makes it when you do it. And, you know, turning off iCloud services, you know, it's something that shouldn't have to be terrifying. And it's mostly terrifying because of this alert message that Apple has chosen to display. It's kind of a language. I don't think it's actually what's going on. It's, you know, how Apple presents it to us. And like Peter, I've on occasion made the choice to actually turn off my iCloud syncing services to kind of troubleshoot something. So you have, you know, maybe some contacts that aren't syncing quite properly, or maybe something's going on with your calendars that's a little bit weird. And you're like, well, maybe I'll just try resetting iCloud. You know, I'll just disconnect the calendar and reconnect and let it sync back up. And maybe that will solve my problem. But every time I do it, I swear to you, my heart completely leaps into my throat, because you go into System Preferences, you go into iCloud, and for example, uncheck the box for calendars. And this is the message that you get. Quote, if you stop using iCloud for calendars, calendars stored in iCloud will be deleted from this Mac. Your calendars will still be available on other devices using iCloud. End quote. And then the only button, just to make it more scarier, the only button choice that you get, or button choices rather, that you get are delete from Mac, and I believe that's the default, or cancel. And so you're like, if you read it, you're immediately going to like cancel, because you're like, what do you mean you're going to delete all my calendars from my Mac? And It's only a little bit better for contacts because at least contacts does have a keep contacts option in addition to the delete from my Mac option. And iCloud Drive, forget it. You know, iCloud says all your iCloud documents are going to be deleted from your Mac. And if you actually read the message and think about it for a little bit, it does make sense. It's, you know, clear that when you reconnect to iCloud, your data is still going to be there and it's going to sync back to your Mac. But even knowing that, you know, and I know that, it gives me pause every time I do it. And I think it's that word delete from your Mac. It's like, what do you mean I'm going to, like, erase my data, my valuable contact and calendar data from my Mac? And it's sort of like, yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do. And I don't like anybody deleting stuff from my Mac, but me. And it's that word delete that's really bad because it sounds so permanent. And I get so paranoid that if I am going to disable iCloud services, I will actually sometimes go into mail, contacts, or calendars in advance and kind of pull an extra backup just in case. So I'll go, you know, open the calendar app, go under the file menu. There's an export option and you can create a calendar archive. And there's the same option inside contacts. Contacts under file, export, and you can do a contacts archive. And this is despite the fact that I know I have a Time Machine backup, a Super Duper backup, and a Crash Plan backup of all that same data. But, you know, this is my life. This is everybody I know. This is every place I have to be. I cannot afford to lose that data. And I'm not sure what Apple could do to kind of change this message or tone it down. And I don't know why I don't trust that iCloud will reliably sync back my data once I've re-enabled the sync. I guess Apple hasn't had the greatest reputation when it comes to cloud storage. And I also guess I worry that in turning it back on, it'll say, oh yeah, the Mac you just re-enabled for syncing has no contacts on it, so therefore I need to sync nothing to all the other devices. And I know it doesn't work that way. Believe me, I know that it's going to sync, you know, from here to there and from there to here, and I shouldn't have that fear, but I absolutely do. And I think some of it's to history. If syncing is this tricky thing, and it's not always reliable. And in the old days, it was very rarely reliable. So if you've been around for long enough like me and you've had a sync operation go completely south on you, go completely wrong, then you're kind of overly suspicious, I think, and less trustful of syncing operations, even if it's Apple who's doing the syncing. But I guess, you know, it's like Peter sort of concludes in his piece that the process is intimidating. And intimidating, he says, should never be a word that we associate with the Mac or iOS user experiences. And I kind of concur and agree with that. So I don't know what the solution is. Maybe you have some ideas, but I just thought it was a great piece and something that needed to be talked about and said, because it's certainly a fear that I have. What about you? Here's a cool little tip that our friend Jeff Gamet wrote up over at the Mac Observer. In iOS 8's mail application, you may or may not be aware, there are these swipe gestures that you can do on the messages list. And that allows you to access or have quick access to certain features like archiving a message or marking it as read, things like that. And I think out of the box, by default, swipe to the left allows you to archive or trash a message. Swipe to the right allows you to mark it as read, and swiping left kind of part way and stopping about halfway through lets you access these additional options like more, flag, and archive or delete options. And you can actually, the tip is that you can actually control these swipe behaviors, at least to a certain degree. If you tap on settings and then tap on mail, contacts, and calendars, and then tap on the swipe options, you'll see that you can change the swipe to left option, and you can control what shows up in that little middle square. When you swipe partway to the left, you can set it to be none, mark as read, or flag. And then with the swipe to right gesture, it can be mark as read, flag or archive. And that's neat enough in and of itself, but an even cooler thing for someone like me who likes to be able to have quick access to a trash as well as an archive option, if you look at the little text under the archive setting, what you'll see is it says that if you are already using an account that has archive as the default option, which would be the, you know, swipe to the left all the way option by default, then instead of archive, that swipe to right option that's set to archive actually becomes trash. So now you can have a swipe gesture for archive, swiping to the left, and then swiping to the right would be trash on any accounts where archive is the default action instead of trash. So that would be things like Gmail, for example, always archives your email. It does not necessarily trash it unless you specifically say, I want this to go to the trash folder. And so that's a quick and easy way to set that up using swipe gestures in iOS 8. And that's probably my favorite part of this tip. But I thought it was a great little tip, and thanks to Jeff for writing that up. And I'll have a link to Jeff's full article at themacobserver.com in the show notes if you want to check it out. And then finally for today, here's a little tip or a bit of information to help you thwart bad guys who are trying to ruin your day. And specifically, most recently, they tried to ruin Charles' day because he emailed me in a panic because he had an issue where a member of his family had visited a legitimate website, and it was totally legitimate. They were surfing around, and suddenly they got this pop-up alert about malware being on their computer. And it was a pop-up dialog box as well as a web page that came up that said, the dialog box said, Chrome alert, suspicious activity detected. Chrome may get stuck as an anonymous activity, or Chrome may get stuck as anonymous activity has been found. To fix, please call our support number. And then it gave an 800 toll-free number immediately. Call immediately. It was in this pop-up. And then behind that, there was the web page turned to a giant red window with a white box with a Chrome logo, a Google Chrome logo in it, and big black letters that said, reported phishing website alert. Your network has been monitored. Your network has been compromised due to a browser hijacking. The browser hijacking software may redirect you towards phishing websites that try to access your login password details. To fix the browser redirection, we recommend you ask for instant help via our hotline, and once again, an 800 number. Okay, well, first and foremost, Charles knew immediately that this was bogus. This is phishing junk, and you would probably recognize this as phishing junk immediately. And these are the actual guys that are phishing and trying to hijack you by getting you to call their CD 800 number. But the bad part for Charles was that this little hack also had the effect of being a denial of service attack on his Safari, because what happened was the little, you know, OK dialog box popped up, and it's a little JavaScript controlled dialog box, and the only button in it is OK. And when you click OK, the dialog box just pops up again, and you can't close the window or the page behind that has the big red fake Google Chrome logo and report. So you're basically locked out of Safari. And, you know, it is just some malicious JavaScript, doing that. As far as how it got on the legitimate website, well, we can only really speculate on that. It's possible that the legitimate site was hacked and there was the code for this little phishing attack inserted into their website. But more often these days, I think the way I see these phishing scams being perpetuated is through banner ads that the legitimate site opts into. So they, you know, they participate in these ad networks, and the ad networks aren't being particularly careful about who's able to sign up for and place banner ads on different websites. A lot of these systems are now getting automated, and the bad guys are realizing this, and a lot of those banner ads can execute JavaScript code, and so this kind of garbage gets in there. But the worst trouble for Charles was this denial of service attack that was going on, because quitting Safari didn't help because of a feature that's built into OS X now where, you know, your windows or tabs in Safari reopen up every time you quit the app and reopen it. So he was, you know, quitting Safari, reopening it, and sure enough, the whole process was starting all over again. Well, Charles, the trick here is that you need to be able to quit Safari without having it reopen the windows or tabs the next time you open the app. And the trick is to hold down the Option key when you go under the Safari menu and choose Quit. Because when you hold down the Option key, what you should see is the Quit option change from just simply Quit to now saying Quit and Close All Windows. And that will force that malicious, stupid phishing window to close in Safari. And the next time you open up Safari, it should open with no other tabs, nothing else open. And that should get you back in there. If you try this trick and when you hold down the Option key, instead of seeing the Quit and Close All Windows option, if it says Quit and Keep Windows instead, that means you probably changed the default preference in OS X at some point so that apps would not reopen the windows and tabs. If you're like me, you would have done that because you're old school. Charles, in your case, I don't think you've done that because obviously the phishing thing is giving you the whole DOS. But for anyone else, if you do want to change the setting or just check it, you can go into System Preferences, go into the General System Preferences, and there's a little checkbox that says Close Windows When Quitting Application. If that is checked, then you're sort of running the old school way where every time you quit an app, all the windows are closed down, and the next time you open it, you're kind of starting fresh with no windows open. If you have that unchecked, then you're going to have your applications open up back up any windows that you left open when you quit the app. And this setting is global for all your applications. You cannot sort of set things up on an app-by-app basis, unfortunately. So, Charles, I hope that helps you out with your DOS phishing nastiness. Charles had also asked, you know, do I need to worry about this? Do I have a virus on my computer? I don't think that you do. I don't think this was anything more than a simple JavaScript hack and just staying off that, you know, I'd stay off that page of the legitimate website. You might want to just email support at the legit site and say, hey, this happened to me. You might want to just scan through your code and make sure that you didn't get hacked, because a lot of times hackers will try and slip this code in there unbeknownst to the hosts. They really don't want to get caught. You know, they want their code up and running so that they can maximize the number of people that call into their 800 number and then provide all kinds of additional personal information. That's generally what they're after in these kinds of attacks. But Charles, I think you're fine, and hopefully you've got your Safari back up and running at this point. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. PDF Pen was updated recently, so if you haven't checked it out, you definitely should. And also, check out PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices. Great software from Smile. You can get more information and details on all of it by going to smilesoftware.com. I'd also like to thank Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I love your comments, your emails, your audio comments, especially if you have a topic or something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or if you just have a question, something to say, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281 Mac I Am 9. And if you're in another country or further away and want to save on long distance charges, we also have voicemail on Skype, and my Skype handle is the MacCast, so feel free to leave your messages there. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And I'm also online on social media. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And you'll find us on Google Plus. The Google Plus community is MacCast. Just search for that on Google and you'll be right in there. But with that, that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.